Thank you, Your Honors. Alan Mandel for the appellant, Your Honor. Both my good friend and law school classmate Steve Kozlowski and I are amazed that a case on the Telephone Consumer Protection Act seems to be drawing such widespread interest, as evidenced by the crowd in the court.
A national following here for you.
I think, Your Honors, that there's one point in this case that we can all agree on. And that is that the argument by, again, my good friend and law school classmate, Mr. Kozlowski, in the lower court was improper in large segments. Under Missouri case law, there were when the case was argued to the court, frankly, the closing argument really didn't talk about the facts of the case at all. There were many references to the jury, you can send a clear message. This is a junk lawsuit. This is a frivolous lawsuit. This is the kind of lawsuit that clogs up our courts. You can do something about it today by sending a message that this is not the type of lawsuit that we should tolerate in the courts. I'm not going to bore the court with the entire closing argument. It's set out quite a bit in our brief and certainly in the transcript. Normally, jury nullification issues are up to the discretion of the trial court. But this case differs in one substantial respect. In this case, the argument was objected to, and rather than the trial court sustaining the objection and giving a curative instruction to disregard the comment, the two objections that were made were overruled. So therefore, the improper argument continued and was really all the jury had in terms of determining the facts of this case.
The case differs also in another respect, in that the underlying action is a consumer protection action that's authorized by law. So that figures into the circumstances in which the argument was made.
I think, Judge Breckenridge, you're absolutely correct, because if it wasn't a consumer protection statute and if the case had not gone to the jury under the posture that it had gone to, then this court could look at the jury nullification argument and determine that perhaps the jury decided on other issues. The problem in this particular case is, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act has certain elements that are required for proof of the case. Those elements were outlined in the verdict director that was given to the jury, which is very brief and to the point, and by the way, which did not have a contra. Okay, all the plaintiff had to show in this case to get a recovery and was that first All American Painting was sent one or more fax transmissions by or on behalf of Defendant Financial Solutions, and second, that the fax transmissions sent to All American Painting contained any material advertising the commercial availability of any property, goods, or services, and third, that the fax transmissions sent to All America Painting were received on equipment which has the capacity to describe text or images or both from electronic signal received over a regular telephone line onto paper. That instruction was not contra. There was an instruction submitted on consent, and the court found that consent was an affirmative defense under the statute. There had been insufficient evidence of consent, and that instruction wasn't given.
Can you address the affirmative defense issue? Right.
Yeah.
Is it an affirmative defense or is it part of plaintiff's burden?
It's an affirmative defense under this statute. The burden is on the respondent
defendant. But the statute doesn't say that explicitly. The statute says any material advertising the commercial availability or quality of property, goods, or services which is transmitted to any person without that person's prior express invitation or permission in writing or otherwise. And so it doesn't give us a signal as to whether, at least from the language that's quoted here, but as to whether that's part of the plaintiff's case.
We have some additional guidance, Judge Wolf, in that we do have the Travel Kirkwood case that's cited in our brief that places the burden on the advertiser to show the consent. And I think in this particular case, the defendant failed to satisfy that burden because their instruction that there was evidence of consent was rejected by the trial court.
The Travel Kirkwood case, though, was decided by the Eastern District, who then decided this case the contrary way. Is that correct?
Agreed, Judge Breckeridge. What we have in this case, though, is a memorandum opinion. It's not to be used as precedent, which, you know, I'll rely on today. Normally, I don't like them.
Why was the other case correct in that? Why is it? Why do you read the statute as making it?
The app we're talking about, Judge Stiff, is really almost a strict liability statute. When you send unsolicited faxes, you will be subject to a $500 penalty, which can be trebled by the trial court if it sees fit, if you fit these certain categories. The only defense available to somebody who's accused or sued for sending an unsolicited fax, well, there are two. One, that it wasn't unsolicited, and two, that the reason it's not unsolicited is that somehow there was either express or implied consent
in effect, it's creating an exception to the general rule, so it would normally be defendant's burden to prove it fits within an exception.
The burden shifts, in my opinion, to the advertiser to show, once they're sued under the Act, which contains the elements, the burden shifts to the advertiser to say, okay, we had consent because of this, this, and this. In this particular case, and the reason the instruction is important is, as an affirmative defense, is what is the jury supposed to, how are they supposed to define consent if they're not given an instruction by the court?
Mr. Mandel,
yes,
you're using the word consent, but doesn't the statute actually require them to give you prior permission?
Yes.
Which to me seems to be that has a definition that's more than just consent. It's more than just I don't care. You have to, the way I read the statute, it says you have to give an invitation or give express permission.
Yeah, it's a greater standard. I'm using consent, which is actually a lower standard, and maybe my choice of words is not artful, but you're absolutely right. It's permission, not consent.
And it's express permission,
express.
Which one of the issues raised by the Eastern District opinion is that it infers the permission.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me ask the question on this express permission. Now, when the trial is part of this case, when the trial court rejected the defendant's proposed instruction, was that based upon the trial court's belief that the defendant had not presented sufficient evidence that they had prior express permission?
I was not trial counsel, and from what I can tell from the record, I believe that's the reason. The proffered instruction was that first, defendant hired active corps to send the faxes on his behalf, and second, active corps sent the faxes, and third, defendant did not control active corps actions in sending the faxes. That was the only instruction proffered. If consent was to go to the jury has to have a definition. They have to have some guidance in determining just what is legal permission under this statute so they can make this decision. They never had any of that. The real burden on my colleague, an opponent in this case, if you look at the argument that was made, which, you know, under the Platt County case, you know, I think we can all agree was improper, is he's got to be able to point to something else other than the fact that the jury didn't like this statute. And we've all dealt with statutes we don't like, but this statute is not under constitutional challenge like so many that the court hears. This is the law. And whether we like this statute or not, the Congress passed it. It's applicable. And a jury's got to have more than just, we don't like this statute, to come up with a ruling that doesn't comply with the statute.
Well, the statute requires express permission. And do you think that can be proved by inference?
Yeah, I don't know that I need to get there, Judge Russell. I don't believe it can. But I don't know that I even need to get there in this case, because in this case we didn't have either express or anything that could be considered, in my opinion, implied. So I'll hang my hat on the express in this particular case, and we don't have to get that far. But the, you know, what I would like my colleague to talk about when he gets up here is to give this honorable court any other thing that was presented in this case other than his very effective argument that maybe this statute is a well-intentioned thing, but people are just using it to make money, and we got to stop clogging up the courts with these small lawsuits. If he can give this court any other hook to hang their hat on for this defense verdict, there is none.
You know, counsel, you've argued that the send a message is improper and the case ought to be overturned because of that jury argument. We instruct our juries to base their decisions on the evidence, not the argument. We have long allowed our lawyers great leeway in making closing arguments, and our trial courts great leeway in determining prejudice. How would you write a decision that would allow that leeway to the lawyer and the judges and still have your side prevail? What would you advise that we would say?
What I would distinguish this case on, Justice Price, is number one, the incorrect trial court ruling in overruling the objection to the improper argument. I mean, I agree. I don't know that I would be standing here making the same argument if the objections had been sustained with a curative instruction to the jury to disregard. That happens all the time. I myself have been known to make an argument that has been objectionable.
You okay. Probably asked juries to send messages, right?
And that I think that would have cured the jury nullification argument. I think we still would have had the problem that there's just no evidence to support a defense verdict.
But don't we see the trial court judges being in the best position there in the courtroom to see what kind of effect it could have upon the trial? Don't we defer to that? And if the trial court judge determined that this is not something that he needs to or she needs to sustain or give a curative instruction, isn't our standard of review to defer to that?
I got to say yes, unless it's an abuse of that discretion. And if you read the language used here in this argument and the way it goes on and on and on, it gets worse after the objections were overruled. I mean, there's every catchphrase that's used by anybody that's got a problem with the civil justice system is in this closing argument. And I think that's a real problem. When the court overrules the objection, it gives the argument the imprimatur of approval.
Well, can the counsel in final argument quote the Bible, even though the Bible's not in evidence?
I've seen it happen. I think that it is very fair and proper to quote the Bible, Judge Wolf. You're not going to get me to say ever that it's not.
I've never seen what your limits on the evidence are.
I'm not sure I've seen a verse that says the Bible says there shall not be a fax law.
any further questions?
A higher authority, the Congress of the United States, just had one, says there should be. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you.
May it please the court. I will concede to this court, as I did to the Court of Appeals, that part, but certainly not all, of the closing argument that I made in this case went beyond what was appropriate. But I don't agree that the entire closing argument, as my good friend Mr. Mandel suggests, was composed of that, and the Court of Appeals didn't find that either, in their opinion.
What evidence, if any, did you present that would allow an inference to be drawn, assuming that an inference is allowed to be drawn, that this particular party gave express permission that you could send them the facts that you did?
Well, in fact...
Or do you just say, we didn't send it?
No. And I want to, let me address that question, but there's a tangential issue that I will want to follow up with on that, too. We presented evidence, and in fact, part of this evidence was elicited by the plaintiffs themselves, as the Court of Appeals points out in their opinion, of the fact that the actual fax blaster, ActiveCore, made assurances and spoke to our client, assuring them that all of these people to whom faxes were to be sent were members of organizations through which they had consented.
But that's a different issue, isn't it, than whether or not there was in fact express consent?
No, I don't think it is, Your Honor, because the...
Doesn't it have to be that in fact you got that consent, not just that they told you you got it in order to meet the statute?
Well, no, but the Court of Appeals concluded and I think correctly, that from that evidence, which was uncontested, was undisputed at the trial court level, that the jury could reasonably find or infer that the plaintiffs had expressly consented to receive advertising faxes.
By someone told you that they had joined an organization with these people and part of that was an agreement to get, that they could get faxes in general.
That wasn't the only evidence, Your Honor. That was part of the evidence. The additional evidence beyond that was testimony from the plaintiff's own mouths, which was also quoted by the Court of Appeals in its opinion, in which they said, yes, they were members of these various organizations.
Again, this is set out in the court. Part of them testified they did not give any consent.
They also denied that they had given consent, but there was conflicting evidence. That's the point. There was evidence by which a jury could find, contrary, even though the plaintiffs themselves denied it, which, of course, you would expect them to do, there was contrary evidence on which the jury could find that consent had, in fact, been given.
And what was the evidence that consent, as opposed to somebody telling you that they had gotten it, was there the actual evidence, non-hearsay evidence?
Keep in mind that the plaintiffs did not even come to court on this case. Uh-huh. So the only evidence from the plaintiffs was through depositions, and in their depositions, as the Court of Appeals points out in an opinion, in its opinion, they testified that they were members of organizations similar to the kind of organizations that ActiveCore told my client about. So the evidence from two different directions was corroborative.
But,
now, the jury could
simply,
have chosen.
Yes. Simply being a member of an organization is not giving express permission that you receive faxes.
Did you introduce evidence of agreements in these organizations or something like that, some direct proof that from the membership or organization agreement?
The proof of their consent to receive faxes as a result of being members of this organization came from my client based upon the conversations that he had with ActiveCore. That was not the only evidence, as I say. There was also evidence from the plaintiffs themselves that they were members of this organization. So the Court of Appeals, in reviewing that, found there was at least evidence from which the jury could decide. They may have discarded that evidence. They had that right. They might have believed the plaintiffs who came in and said through their depositions, no, we never consented.
Again,
but
let me ask you this specific question. Was there evidence that beyond being members of the organization, they had expressly consented to receiving faxes?
That they were...
Not just that they were members of an organization.
Yes, there was evidence through my client based on what he had been told by ActiveCore that was the basis of these people being on the list in the first place.
From what I saw in the ActiveCore and what they told your client, there was no evidence of any actual agreement that this ActiveCore told your client. Your client didn't see anything. Your client was relying on someone else's statement that as part of the membership, They had agreed, but there's no written showing of any agreement. Why is it hearsay that somebody told you what something else said and they didn't identify specific organizations?
Well, the evidence was received. It may have been hearsay, but it was first elicited by the plaintiffs themselves and then received in evidence. So there was evidence in the record, and it was properly admitted. In fact, as I say, they elicited it in the first place.
Whose burden was it? Was it your burden or was it plaintiff's burden?
As the Court of Appeals says in its opinion, the law on the issue of consent under the TCPA is unclear.
Let me ask again, what does consent have to do with anything in this case?
Because
the statute clearly says permission. It doesn't say consent.
Well, Judge, the other cases that have looked at this issue talk about this issue in terms of consent. One of the cases that I cited in my brief, and I think it's attached to my brief that was filed, is a federal district court case out of the Northern District of Illinois, which says that consent, and it talks about it in terms of consent, notwithstanding, I agree with you, the statute doesn't use exactly that word, but that's what the cases talk about, as being an element for burden, the burden of proving an element on the plaintiff, not an affirmative defense. Now, there may be other cases out there that have held otherwise, and I don't think there's any case out of the U.S. Supreme Court at this point which controls that determination, but the fact of the matter is there's at least that district court case which says it was their burden. Now, I want to clarify one thing that I meant to talk to you about, Judge Sell, this idea of the verdict director. There's a misunderstanding and a misstatement, and I don't criticize Alan for it because he wasn't there the instruction that I offered that was refused by the trial court, which Alan just read, had nothing to do with the issue of consent. That verdict, or excuse me, that instruction had to do with whether or not, because ActiveCorp was the party who in fact sent the faxes, and whether or not we had any control over whether ActiveCorp sent them to people who had given permission or not given permission. And there's a case out of the state of Alabama. The Alabama Supreme Court said that under those circumstances, my client would not be liable if a third party acted without our being able to control them. I offered that instruction. The trial court refused it. The verdict director in this case, I objected to. And if I had lost, I would be appealing from that verdict director because it doesn't include the element of consent. The Court of Appeals found, and I think correctly, that the element of consent was tried by consent. In fact, the evidence elicited by the plaintiffs. So even if you find or conclude that that was an affirmative defense that should have been pleaded and so forth, in fact, it was tried in the case.
But counsel, the opposing party also points out that whether or not it was tried by consent, if it's an affirmative defense, you have to submit it, and you failed to do so, so you waived it. You can't.
Well,
you failed to submit it. The jury couldn't return a verdict based on something that was not submitted to them.
Well, Judge, the Court of Appeals cited Rule 55, which is 5533B, I think it is, which is the rule concerning amending of pleadings by virtue of the fact of the issues, in fact, having been.
No, I understand that, and assuming for the present purposes that that occurred, you
yes.
still have to submit it. You can't win based on an affirmative defense the jury is not asked to consider.
Well,
if it's an affirmative defense, it was your burden to offer an appropriate instruction on that.
I agree with that. If it was clear, the law were clear, which I don't think it is.
On what basis could the jury have come back for you absent that affirmative defense? Since that was not submitted, what was your defense?
I think the verdict directing instruction itself was faulty. The issue of consent had to be submitted either in their verdict director, which it was not, or in my affirmative defense, which it was not.
But if it's an affirmative defense and you chose not to submit it, that doesn't mean they have to submit it for you.
But I don't know that there's no law in this state or, for that matter, elsewhere that tells me that it is an affirmative defense, Judge. In fact, I have law that I've cited to you that says to the contrary.
I appreciate that. But if the court were to hold that it was an affirmative defense that wasn't submitted, then I'm trying to get to what other defense you offered. A question was asked earlier beyond arguing to the jury that it was a bad law and so forth. You didn't have another defense, and you've identified that you had this issue of consent. If that's not in the case, was there something else?
There is something else. That there are two issues that were tried to the court in which there were factual disputes, consent being one of them. The second one was whether or not these faxes were in fact sent to the plaintiffs that were in the case. There was considerable evidence in the case as to whether or not the named plaintiffs were the objects of the receipt of the faxes. So even if you conclude that part of my argument went too far, part of my distaste for not the statute, but for what I think is the abuse of the statute by people who file these things on a routine basis, even if you conclude that that's the case, there was two elements at least on which the jury's verdict could be supported. First, the consent issue, and second, whether or not these plaintiffs were the ones to whom these faxes were sent.
Let me talk to you for just
yes,
a moment about the consent, or what we've been calling
yep.
the permission issue. Did you and the plaintiff in your final argument, you mentioned that it came up during the evidence in the case, was there argument on the question, well, hey, they consented to it, or hey, you know, we had that.
Absolutely.
So
I argued it.
You argued it.
I certainly did.
And was that objected to?
No, it was not. Well, there were two objections that were made during closing argument. The first was the jury nullification objection, which was overruled. Then there was another objection after that, which was not jury nullification anymore. It was a question of, I'll be honest with you, I don't remember what the objection was. But during the course of my argument, I did make an argument that even if you don't buy in to my argument that this is lawsuit abuse, there are a couple of factual issues which preclude the entry of a verdict for the plaintiffs. Consent was one of them, and the other was the plaintiff's faxes. Judge, I apologize that I don't remember at what point the second objection came up. Obviously, the transcript reveals it. I looked at it yesterday, but it just escapes me now what that was. I know it was not another.
It's not raised in the points relied on.
No, no, that's right. That's not the subject of the criticism of my closing argument. It was on a different point.
Your argument about who, that the plaintiffs are not the proper parties.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that the faxes were sent to an individual name and then to a company name. On one document, it had the individual's name and then the company. And it's the company that sued. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. Well, that's part of it. And there are also instances where, at least one instance, where the named plaintiff wasn't mentioned on the fax at all. But in other words, there were two different names beyond the named plaintiff.
Although I thought they say in their brief there's some testimony that they were doing business under those names.
I know there's some testimony to the contrary, but that made it a factual dispute that I think the jury had to decide. I mean, just because the plaintiffs deny it doesn't mean the jury has to accept that that's the case. They had that factual issue before them. They could have concluded and agreed with my evidence to suggest that we had the wrong plaintiffs here, that those weren't the people who actually were the recipients. Just as they could have agreed with the argument that these folks had given consent.
Well, wouldn't that negate your, isn't that inconsistent with your argument that there was an agreement? Are these individuals or members of organizations? Who are you alleging gave prior permission for the faxes? Was it the individuals or the companies?
The plaintiffs.
And the individual plaintiffs?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think it's inconsistent. I think they're in the alternative. I would agree that. I'm saying that the named plaintiffs were members of the organization, if that's to whom the faxes were sent. But even if you don't agree that there was evidence, I'm saying to the jury, that the folks, organizations gave consent, I still say that the wrong plaintiffs have been brought this lawsuit.
You made a comment about, you know, some cases that you cited which suggest that it may not be an affirmative defense. That it may be plaintiff's burden that you cited your case. In your research, did you find cases that said otherwise, that did suggest that based upon statutory interpretation that it was an affirmative defense?
I only remember finding this Hinman case, which is
the Illinois case.
I'm sorry?
The Illinois case.
The Federal District Court case. That's correct. I don't know what's come down since then. I know at the time when we were at the Court of Appeals, counsel for the plaintiffs cited to some federal regulations, pretty extensive ones, as support for the fact that it was an affirmative defense. Those regulations did suggest that it was affirmative defense.
That would be consistent with the policy behind the statute, which is that it's a remedial statute and it's intended to do what it does and to require the plaintiff to prove that as part of its burden seems to me to be putting an unrealistic burden on the plaintiff.
Well, I agree, but the federal court in Chicago did not agree. They didn't just suggest, Judge, that judge didn't just suggest that it might be an affirmative or might be their burden. He said very expressly in that opinion that it was the plaintiff's burden. Now, maybe he's wrong. And the law, as I say, is unsettled. But at the time we tried this case, that was the state of the law. It certainly wasn't clear that it was an affirmative defense that I had to plead or submit an instruction.
Counsel, you've been arguing that the advertising agency told your client that it was proper for them to send this out.
Yes, sir.
As I'm sitting here, why aren't they the real party defendant as opposed to your client?
I made that argument to the jury, too. That was one of my arguments.
So it's one of your arguments. We didn't send these, so we're not liable at all.
I had made an empty chair argument to the jury. It was one of the other arguments I made. My closing argument wasn't all about the, you know, lawsuit abuse issue. And I said, they're not here. They could have been here.
You hired them to do this for you, though, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
We did.
Was agency pled?
Actually,
they,
Your
they
Honor,
were your agent doing this?
This may be somewhat outside the record, so I hesitate. They were brought in as a third-party defendant by me initially, and they are a Canadian company. And basically, we hit a dead end in terms of trying to actually actively bring them into the case. But I say that may or may not be part of the legal file that plaintiffs filed, but that was what happened with ActiveCorp. Thank you.
Mr. Mandel, you still haven't told me how I'm supposed to write this case and say you can't make this send a message argument here, but lawyers still have wide latitude in making closing arguments and judges have wide latitude in determining prejudice.
Let me try, although it's kind of above my pay grade, which is why you're there, and I'm here.
Yeah, it would be below the pay grade, is where we are.
As I stated earlier, okay, I'm not up here arguing against showing deference to the trial court in determining when a closing argument is so prejudicial that it becomes a nullification argument or weighs a reversal. What I am here arguing, and I think the court, if the court would see fit to reverse this case, can hang its hat on this, is that here we have improper argument that was objected to, overruled, and then continued. And just the weight of this particular argument. I mean, in law school, Steve was a very passionate guy. But to suggest that if you're found for the plaintiff in this case, you'll just be feeding the beast is a little bit, you know, a little bit over the top. You know, stop wasting the judge's time, who has more important cases and more important matters to deal with. If you send a verdict otherwise, if you award the plaintiffs the verdict that they want, you'll just be feeding the beast. You'll be encouraging this. You'll be wanting, encourage them to come back and file more and continue the assembly line operation to make some money. That's the message that you want to send. That's over the top.
So it's a combination of all things, no one.
I don't think he should have called you a beast.
That may change after today. It's over the top. And, you know, here, this statute, you know, allowing for a $500 civil verdict, you know, it doesn't when you argue the case that way, Congress saw a need for this kind of statute. But when you argue the case that way to a jury, when there's no facts that indicate that the statute was complied with, is basically saying to the jury, look, I don't like this law. It's a stupid law. It's clogging up the courts with $500 cases, and just don't apply the law. And that's exactly what happened.
Now, could the jury instead have just found that his client didn't send this, that it was this advertising company in Canada?
Except, could they, Your Honor, and I'm not going to read them to you, but there were that facts appearing without substantial controversy that were given to the jury, findings of fact, uncontested, and a lot of the questions that the court had asked regarding who did what to who are covered in the stipulated facts that were given to the jury.
On the regulations, is there a regulation that sets out that it's an affirmative defense? Is there a regulation implementing?
The FCC regulation, Judge Teilman, puts the burden as an affirmative defense on the defendant, and more importantly, it also talks about the issue of permission. And Judge Fisher, you're absolutely right. It's permission, not consent, a much higher standard.
And the structure of these kinds of laws are the statute and the regulations are law as they apply to the statute.
There's a regulatory scheme in these things, as there are in many federal statutes. The FCC has jurisdiction to formulate regulations for the implementation of the statute, and they have done that in this particular case in terms of permission, what the standard is. The real problem with Steve saying, well, the jury decided they had permission, is the jury had nothing to define it. There was nothing in an instruction. There was, you know, the court is the arbiter of the law. The jury is the arbiter of the facts. And the court gave the jury no law.
But the regulation says, like Regulation Z for Truth in Lending, if the regulation says it should be an affirmative, it should be tried as affirmative defense, and that's...
Exactly. The FCC regulations are part and parcel of the record of the case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The case is taken under submission.